Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, May 22nd, 2025, and our friend Alex Craner is back with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for having me, Nima. Good to join you again.
Alex, let's talk about what's going on between the United States and Iran. It's Steve Witkoff. Every time he's changing his rhetoric toward the talks between the United States and Iran, the new rhetoric is that no enrichment. And it was so serious for the Iranian party because the leader, the supreme leader of Iran, talked about it. The foreign minister of Iran said, doesn't matter what they're talking about, we don't need any sort of permission on the part of the United States, with or without a deal between Iran and the United States, we enrich uranium. And they even wanted to cancel the fifth round of negotiations between Iran and the United States. And at the last moment, they have decided just to go to talk with the United States. Do you understand what does the U.S. want from these negotiations? Are they playing around with Iran, or they want something with Iran?
Obviously, I'm going to have to guess because I don't know. And I don't think that anybody really truly knows unless you're on the inside of the administrations. So, you know, first of all, I think it's always important not to regard any one country as a monolith. So, you know, to say what does the United States want is probably oversimplifying it. I think that we have to consider the internal forces pulling on Trump administration policies. We know that there are powerful forces that desperately and fanatically want a war against Iran. And then my strong impression is that Donald Trump and people like J.D. Vance and some others on the team, probably Witkoff as well, desperately want to avoid this. But the pressures on them are very, very considerable. And so as we saw, Witkoff came back to Washington after one round of negotiations, a meeting with his Iranian counterparts, feeling like he won a bit of a diplomatic break in that the Iranians offered to commit not to acquire nuclear weapons and to strictly limit their uranium enrichment to only civilian uses. And it seems to me that Witkoff and Trump thought, okay, this is a small win. This is a basis to go forward on, to take the next step. But then for some reason, they changed their minds and they were like, no, absolutely no kind of enrichment at all. Why do you need nuclear energy at all? You have all this oil and all this nonsense that has been slushing around the information space for more than 20 years now. You're right. Iran has, under international law, they have every right to develop nuclear energy for civilian uses, for, you know, energy and medical uses. And they don't need to ask the Americans for permission. But I think there's extremely powerful pro-Israel lobby where people feel that it's now or never, you know, that this is maybe their last chance to get rid of Iran and to eliminate Iran as a power in the region, which would then leave Israel as the, you know, as the undisputed regional hegemon, you know, in their fantasies, in their minds. And so they feel that now that they have, let's call it a pro-Zionist administration in the White House, that it's their chance. And because Israel is crumbling like a house of cards as we speak, and they are literally on the tipping point of a possible civil war, their only last hope is a major military escalation in the region that would then push the United States to step in, it would be, I think it would be very difficult for Trump to avoid coming to Israel's aid because of, you know, American internal politics. And then if the United States stepped in, then, you know, they could drag the whole of NATO into that war, and it would be a disaster for everyone. The only party there that would gain, and it's again a very uncertain gain, would be Israel and their Zionist supporters. And I'm not just talking about the United States. I'm also talking about Great Britain, because, you know, let's not forget, it's not irrelevant that Great Britain and the undead British Empire were the originators of the Zionist projects. They set it up, they created it, and they're still arming it, providing with intelligence, and supporting it in every way that they can, completely against the wishes of the populations. But it is what it is, you know. And so these are powerful vested interests that are exerting strong pressure on Trump administration, which I think is trying to avoid that conflict. But, you know, we'll see how that goes.
Alex, Donald Trump has visited Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Qatar just last week. And they were, I argue that one of the main subjects, one of the main topics to be discussed in this sort of visit was the case of Iran, because they're so much afraid of a new war, a direct war between Iran and the United States in the Middle East. That would be devastating for all of these countries in the Persian Gulf. And do you think, do they have some sort of weight, some sort of influence on the Trump administration when it comes to that sort of policies toward Iran?
Do you mean to say whether the Saudi
war, just not going to war with Iran, just influence the Israeli lobby, not somehow neutralizing the Israeli lobby in the United States and putting pressure on the Trump administration?
Yes.
Because they're investing a lot in the United States. Look at the numbers.
Yes. Yes. I think this is exactly it. You know, I think this is exactly what's going on. I think that the war would be absolutely devastating for everybody in the region, including for the United States, and that they are all trying to do what they can to avoid that war. Now, I'm going to venture a guess that all these investments that go to the United States from the UAE, from Qatar, from Saudi Arabia, are actually a proxy economic or financial fight between the United States and Britain, because so far the Saudis and the Qataris and Oman and the UAE have been in a very close relationship with the United Kingdom since, you know, for the last 100 years. And all those relationships still exist. They're very strong. You know, the Brits have a very strong military and intelligence cooperation with the Qataris. They even have they've even made two military bases, two air bases in the UK available to the Qataris, where they train Qatari pilots on the jet fighters that they sell to Qatar. And then the Qataris, you know, they have invested very, very heavily in the United Kingdom. And, you know, I think that the Qataris and the Saudis own something like a quarter of the London Stock Exchange. You know, they invested in the big Shard skyscraper in London, which is, you know, one of these big monstrosities that was recently built there. Harrods and things like this. So a lot of the money that they earn from their sale of oil and gas is recycled in Britain through London, which is helping float up the British financial system, which is otherwise in a catastrophic state. And so Trump went there And he negotiated that a lot of their investment will now be going to the United States, a greater extent. So, you know, the dollars that go to the United States are not going to go to London. And so I think that in this sense, Trump is eating London's lunch there. And at the same time, his, I think, weakening the hand of London, which is still extremely influential in the Middle East. I think that if this is correct, what I'm saying, I think that it's actually a path to peace, because if you look at the things closely, it is true that the United States has been the military enforcement arm of the Western Empire's colonialism in the region, but the actual instigator for decades has been London. And so I think that marginalizing the role of the City of London and of the British foreign policy establishment in the region is actually putting us a step closer on the path to peace.
I want to talk about the role of British, but focusing on what's going on in between Iran and Israel, we have various reports from CNN. Axios just yesterday reported that Israel is preparing to attack Iran. And here is what they said. In Axios, they're talking about Israel is considering just not a single strike, but a prolonged military operation against Iran. The campaign could last several days. And Alex, I cannot imagine Donald Trump joining Israel to attack Iran, because that would be the end of what he wants to do with the United States and the bigger picture. If they let Israel to attack Iran, and if Israel wants to attack Iran for several days, how would you see Iran responding to Israel? Because we know that Israel, when a single ballistic missile from Yemen goes and hit the Ben Gurion airport, which is the most secured place in Israel, and how can they imagine a response from Iran?
Well, I think that's exactly the point, because Israel is now in such a precarious position that I think their only hope to gain further life expectancy for the whole Zionist project is to escalate their various conflicts to a massive regional war, and then to force the United States to come into their defense, to pull the United States into a quagmire, basically. So I think that if Israel attacked Iran again, Iran would respond, most probably, and they would respond in a very powerful way. And then the whole Zionist lobby in the United States would probably go absolutely hysterical, and they would exert tremendous pressure on the Trump administration to intervene. And I think that given the nature of this Zionist zealotry, it is possible that they would prevail, because, you know, if you, I didn't get very deeply into the, you know, into the end times biblical interpretations by these born again Christians in the United States, but it seems to me that their interpretations are such that if Donald Trump or any American leader failed to step in to defend Israel in the case of some kind of an Armageddon scenario in the Middle East, that they might well label him Antichrist. And they, you know, that's the mindset. That's for real to them. And so that's a very, very dangerous game then. And it, you know, the Israelis understand that. And then there's also this biblical aspect that, you know, you and I spoke about once, I think, back in December, that there are certain Jewish rabbis who believe in again, in the framework of Jewish eschatology, that, you know, the Israel has to antagonize all her neighbors to draw their wrath on Israel and provoke basically the whole world to unite against Israel in order for Israel to be punished severely and thereby to earn its redemption. And then only once they have earned their redemption can the, you know, long-awaited Messiah come to them. Now, I know that this doesn't make sense for people who look at history from day to day and who think that, you know, under Abrahamic religion, the God still has the injunction on all of us, thou shalt not kill. But we're talking about religious zealots, people who are so fanatically devoted to a certain set of beliefs that it wouldn't matter what you tell them. It wouldn't matter what everybody else in the world thinks. And so, you know, in that framework, attacking Iran on their own would be a small thing, you know. it would just be a logical next step for them to do. And I mean, you know, a few weeks ago, Trump said that if you attack Iran, you're on your own. You know, we're going to stay out. But, you know, Trump can think that, he can say that, but he has a large, powerful faction behind his back who are going to go absolutely apeshit to make sure that the United States joins in that war. So it's going to be a very dangerous escalation. I think that this is the reason perhaps why, you know, Iran has been preparing diligently for that, but also the Russians, my understanding is the Russians have provided them with their own radar technologies to detect these attacks and the anti-aircraft and anti-missile technologies so that they could repel this attack. And if they are successful at repelling this attack, then maybe this is going to act as a deterrent for anybody to even think of continuing on this path, or for the United States to join in, because, you know, if it's futile, then, you know, maybe let's not do it.
If we consider the latest moves on the part of the Trump administration, that Donald Trump himself, when it comes to Yemen, they have decided to withdraw from Yemeni waters. And U.S. aircraft carrier just left the Yemeni waters, and they're just made a deal with Yemen. Donald Trump announced that they capitulated, all of that, that we know wasn't the case. But look at last time Donald Trump, in his first administration, when he went to the Middle East, he went to Israel as well. The situation right now is, we can argue that the relationship between Trump administration and Netanyahu administration is not that good as it was before in the first administration. There are some sort of attrition, some sort of friction between the two parties. And do you think that it's all about Gaza, or it's about Iran and the Middle East as well?
I think that it's about both, because, you know, by this time nobody can ignore Gaza. And even the mainstream media are now backing away from their unconditional support for Israel. It seems to me that Benjamin Netanyahu is starting to be pushed under the bus, even by people who were formerly his supporters. I think that Netanyahu is about finished. It's a matter of time, and probably not a very long time, that he will in one way or another be removed from office. There is a risk that Israel could slip into a civil war, which would completely change the chessboard in the Middle East. I don't know that anybody can predict what happens from that point on. But then, you know, for other people, for other actors in the region, I think it makes sense to try to wait it out, and that includes the Iranians and it includes the United States, because escalating to a war against Iran would have very strong cohesive effect on Israeli society. You know, big external war, external enemy. It doesn't matter. Maybe we all hate Netanyahu, but we have to close ranks. We have to unite and defend ourselves. So this is, again, you know, why a war against Iran would be the, let's say, the most desirable next development for the pro-Zionist camp. The United States doesn't necessarily have those interests. You know, the United States, the Trump administration has already made it clear that they are backing away from the post-World War II global order, that they are rejecting the rules-based global order, and that they have given a clear signal that they wish to embrace the multipolar integrations. So, you know, Iran is a very important component here. Iran has very strong relations with Russia and with China. Iran is right there, an essential component of the new North-South international trade corridor. If Trump went to war against Iran, that would derail multipolar integrations. It would destroy the United States relationship, not only with Iran, but also with Russia and with China. And then it would completely throw the United States back into the globalist camp, and they would find themselves again in the same camp with France, Great Britain, the EU, and NATO, which is, I think by now it's very clear that this is not what Trump wants. But he's fighting powerful opposition at home politically. So, you know, again, it's never correct to regard the United States as some sort of a monolith where only one political option is considered by everyone. I think that earlier this week, you know, Larry Johnson on his channel published an interview with Douglas McGregor. And in that interview, Douglas McGregor recounted his experience when he was a senior advisor to the acting Secretary of Defense. And he was brought into the during the first Trump administration. And he was brought into the administration by Donald Trump because he wanted to withdraw American troops from Afghanistan, Syria, Iran, and from Europe. And so he brought Colonel Douglas McGregor to say, okay, so how do we do that? And then McGregor told him, look, you can't do all of those things. You can do one thing. And so he said, okay, how do we get the people out of Afghanistan? And end of the story, Douglas McGregor drafted an executive order for Trump to sign. Trump received it. He was, okay, this is excellent. I love this. And he signed the executive order. And then, as Douglas McGregor said, all hell broke loose. And everybody went out of their minds. The Senate Armed Services Committee, key senators like Mitch McConnell, the acting defense secretary, all of these people from the administration and from the House of Representatives descended on the White House. And ultimately, they ended up talking Trump out of it because, you know, the U.S. has certain arrangements with its allies in Afghanistan, and these allies have powerful interests and they have powerful lobbyists in Washington. And then there's a lot of contractors who were making a lot of money in Afghanistan. And so in the end, Trump had to back down, and he didn't completely give up, but the best he could do is draw down the troops to 5,000 about. And those 5,000 had to stay because these were the contractors. These were the people making money in Afghanistan. And so I think that you know, as this happened in 2016, I think that in the same way today, whenever Trump wants to make some radical change to US policy, there's a lot of powerful interests who are going to push back hard. And as we've seen recently, some of them actually want Trump dead, and they're not shy to let it be known. So it's, you know, it's not like Trump can, because he's the commander in chief, he issues an order and then everybody steps into line and the order is executed. I think it's a struggle.
Alex, on the part of Iranians, when I look at Iran and the way that they have suffered to reach the point that they have reached in terms of nuclear program in Iran, look at the assassinations, various assassinations of Iranian scientists during the years. And it's so simplistic and so, I would say, so much unrealistic to think Iran would give up its nuclear program and its enrichment. They're not going to do that. They have to find something with Iran if Donald Trump is interested in reaching a deal with Iran. And right now, Rubio is talking about snapback sanctions. This snapback sanction is a regime that was considered during JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, between Iran and the other party, which is the West, together with Russia and China. If we assume they go in that direction, the United States doesn't have the power it had before. Right now, Europe is not that much powerful. Russia and China are not playing in the hand of the United States or coordinating somehow with the United States. They're going to be alone going against Iran. I don't know if they assume, if they consider that in the process of their strategy, the way that they're preparing their strategy.
I think that some people in the Trump administration have considered that, and they're perfectly aware of it. But there are some people who don't care what the consequences are going to be. They have their agenda, they have their plans, and they want them realized. And I think that there's a lot more passion and urgency on the side of the warmongers than there is on the side of people who are trying to forge a different direction. I'm moderately optimistic because I'm encouraged by the fact that Trump has reopened positive, constructive relations with the Russians. The Russians, I'm sure, will try to accommodate Trump and make his life easier because they understand that he's facing stiff opposition at home and powerful push in the direction, you know, they want him to recommit to Ukraine, they want him to provide security guarantees, they want him to go to war against Iran and so on and so forth. And I think that the United States has to chart that course very cautiously. I think that the Chinese are aware of that. I think that even Iranians are aware of all this. You know, it's what we know are things that are being published and spoken for public consumption. So we have to take everything with a grain of salt. I think that when Trump and Putin talk, when Trump and Xi talk, when Witkoff meets with the Iranians and with the Russians, that they talk the real stuff. They understand much better what's going on than what they give away and what they suggest to the public. And I think that they are taking all these realities into account and they're trying to make positive difference. And I think that, you know, I use Ray McGovern's expression. I think that the glass is three quarters full. I really do believe that. But the battle is not won. And it's uncertain how it will end. But I, you know, as you say, the United States is no longer as powerful. So I think that therefore, on the one hand, Trump cannot proceed with force and expect that he will prevail. And on the other hand, being in a weaker position than the United States was maybe 30 years ago, he has very strong incentives to cooperate and to cultivate friendly relations with other regional powers like Iran and China and Russia. But because of the political realities that he's facing at home, he has to be very careful about how he charts their course, because he's still wading through the swamp. And you can see, you know, Witkoff comes back with a concession from Iranians, and they think that, wow, you know, this is a good step forward, and then they get buried by the pro-Zionist camp. And then Pete Hegseth votes against attacking Iran, and they want his head on a stake. So, you know, this is probably the reality that they have to cope with every single day. And you know, I feel that ultimately peace will be defended, but it won't be easy.
Alex, the other issue with the foreign policy of the United States, which again, Steve Witkoff has been playing a very important role, is the case of Ukraine. And I don't know anymore who's Steve Witkoff with the case of Ukraine, because he's just disappearing from the scene. And we can hear so much about the conflict in Ukraine from Scott Bessent, from Marco Rubio, which he wasn't talking about Ukraine that much before. And right now it seems that something happening right now in the Trump administration, everybody's talking about Ukraine. And do you think that the latest, the phone call between the two presidents, Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump, could help Donald Trump to understand the realities on the ground in Ukraine? Because you look at the numbers in terms of casualties and the people who were killed and wounded in Ukraine, you don't see Donald Trump has any sort of realistic information on that. I could imagine Vladimir Putin have described everything for him, the situation on the battlefield. How do you see the outcome of that phone call? How is that going to be a game changer in the way that Donald Trump is thinking about the conflict in Ukraine? Because Bloomberg reported, by the way, that Donald Trump is just saying to the Europeans that Ukraine is losing. What do you want to do?
I don't think it's a game changer, Nima, because I think that on the personal level, Trump and Vladimir Putin already had a good relationship, you know, from Trump's first term. They obviously have a healthy respect for one another, and they deal with one another on friendly terms. I think that their conversation, the first one in, what was it, January or February, and this last one last week, I think it was this week, no, on Monday that Trump and Putin spoke. Yeah. I think they were just steps in the right direction of further cultivating their relationship, discussing areas of cooperation, discussing the differences, and bridging those differences. I think that the information they exchange is extremely important. Of course, it helps Trump to understand the situation better. But it's, you know, it's hard to judge how well Trump understands the situation to begin with, because you know, we get the impression that he doesn't. And there's this, you know, there's this urban legend going around that, oh, Trump goes with whoever last spoke with him. So, you know, if Witkoff spoke last with him, he comes out with something. If General Kellogg talks to him last, then he comes out with something completely opposite. I think there's some method to that, you know, because, well, he's been in power now 122 days. Imagine if on the first day he said, okay, we're getting out of Ukraine, that's over, I'm going to fix the relation with Russia, we're going to be friends, and we're going to be doing things completely differently from what the Biden administration has been doing. If he did that, he would have been savaged in the media nonstop for the last 122 days. But by, you know, showing two options and making it seem like he hasn't decided one way or the other. Kellogg was the magnet for people who lobbied for war, you know, particularly the Europeans. So Kellogg was talking to the Europeans. He was traveling to Brussels and London and Paris and Kiev and so on. And everybody thought kind of, you know, we'll convince Kellogg and Kellogg will convince Trump. Meanwhile, I think that Witkoff was the real deal. And the reason why is because Witkoff has a certain personal confidence with Trump. And so he was the channel through which Trump wanted to get the real lay of the land, the real communications with other people. But I think that it would have been very difficult for him to say, like, here, I'm dealing with Steve Witkoff and Kellogg, you know, you can go and retire. So I think that's the method in the madness of Trump administration, that he's deliberately, the reason why it's hard for us to judge what his intentions and what his positions are, is because he believes that he has to conceal his true intentions, exactly to throw his opponents off track. And then we find out what he really wanted to do as things happen. There's still a lot of things that are deplorable, that are really, how do you call it, the policy towards Gaza. It's very hard to justify it. It's bombing of Yemen. How do you square that one? It's extremely difficult. But I think that one of the most important things for Trump to do is to avoid war with Iran. And maybe it seems to me that they're trying to do that. And the other thing that is very important, maybe even more important, is to patch up the relationship with Russia and to abandon this globalist approach and really truly embrace the multipolar integrations with the rest of the world. So I think that we are moving in the right direction, but we're moving in the right direction slowly and in a very bumpy way, which is throwing a lot of people into confusion, not quite understanding what the hell Trump is doing.
Alex, somehow the time is so crucial for both, for the case of the Middle East and the case of Ukraine. Because as time goes by, Donald Trump had the opportunity to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine, in my opinion. And he was part of this campaign against Russia. In his first administration, he's bragging about providing Ukraine with javelins, with those sanctions, those devastating sanctions on Russian economy. And he had, before coming to power in the new administration, he had the opportunity to do that. Yesterday, one of our guests, John Helmer, argued something that I found it somehow realistic, because as time goes by, the war is becoming Trump's war. It's not anymore the Biden's war. He has everything to do with the war in Ukraine. But look at Russia. Russia has decided to talk with Zelensky. Why did Russia decide to do that? Because Donald Trump was incapable of forcing Zelensky. Somehow Europeans, United Kingdom, as you've mentioned, one of the main players in what's going on in Ukraine, have somehow manipulated Zelensky the way that Donald Trump couldn't talk with Zelensky in a proper way, in a way that would convince Zelensky. And Russia said, so what are we going to do? We have to talk with the Ukrainians directly. In my opinion, that was one of the main reasons. How don't you see that Donald Trump is just missing the opportunities he has? And as time goes by, these opportunities are disappearing from the scene.
I have to say that my interpretation of the situation is a little bit more positive than what I heard John Helmer layout. And I think that he is somehow defaulting to the most ominous interpretation of event. He might be right, but I don't see it quite that way. You know, again, you know, I think that there's a discord between what is said and published for public consumption and what is actually happening behind the scenes. I think that there's only so much that Trump can do with regards to Ukraine. You know, that it's his war, I don't necessarily agree with that. And I don't understand why the United States continues to provide intelligence and weaponry to the Ukrainians. But I would not exclude that this is part of the agreement with the Russians. Because now, you know, the Russians are making rapid progress in Ukraine. And my understanding is that the kill ratio between the Russians and the Ukrainians is well in excess of 10 to 1. Maybe it's 20 to 1.
Yeah.
So for as long as the Ukrainians keep fighting, and I think that the troops that are still in the game are largely, you know, the descendants of the Azov battalion, you know, the extremists and mercenaries from other countries. The longer this goes on, the farther the Russians are demilitarizing Ukraine, which is one of their four main goals in Ukraine. So, you know, in the same way as the Russians said to Trump, don't worry about the sanctions, we like the sanctions, they might also say, keep these Ukrainians coming. We're dealing with them. So, you know, they might not, at this stage of the war, they might not want to stop their machine because it's being effective and it's being very successful. I don't know, Nima, but I can't exclude that as a possibility as well. And then, you know, the war, if you end the war now, the war ends at a negotiating table in accordance with the current situation. If Russia inflicts a total defeat on Ukraine, the war ends with a capitulation and Russia completely imposes its own terms for armistice. And at this stage, this could be much more favorable to the Russians. So, you know, maybe they're maneuvering it in this way, and maybe in his own way, Trump is cooperating. Trump has a lot of interest in keeping a positive, constructive relationship with Russia, because Russia will be the guarantor of peace in the region. If Trump is to have any deals in Ukraine and you know, beyond Ukraine with the Russians, because Russia is and remains the world's most wealthiest nation in terms of natural resources, he has a lot of upside in having a good relationship with Russia. And so maybe they said, okay, look, back out of the war. We'll talk to Zelensky, we'll talk to the Ukrainians. It costs them nothing, since that, you know, there are two reasons why Russians would be inclined to speak to the Ukrainians. One is because, as they made it clear, negotiations go alongside the war. So we're not stopping the war while we negotiate, we're continuing. So through negotiations, they buy themselves more time to gain more ground in Ukraine. And the second one is because once this war is finished and the history is written, they will be able to show that at every stage, they gave Ukraine, as well as its Western sponsors, every opportunity to stop and to sue for peace. Okay, so the logic of Russian conduct is quite clear. The logic of Trump's conduct is not so clear, but I think that there are different ways to try to interpret it that actually makes sense. And I think it's not necessary to always go with the you know, some people out there insist on interpreting Trump as though he was the globalist controlled opposition, that, you know, he's fully on board with the globalist, that this is just like a big elaborate deception, and that he's essentially engaged in a big deception against the Russians and everybody else. I actually don't think this is correct.
Alex, when I would say the outcome of the phone call between the United States and between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin was Donald Trump somehow was pushing for ceasefire, then negotiations, and Vladimir Putin said, no, we're going to negotiate while we're fighting Ukraine. And do you understand why they're pushing so much? It's not just about Donald Trump. J.D. Vance, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, is talking about putting more sanctions because the Biden sanctions were so weak. That's why they couldn't achieve anything, which reminds me of what Pete Hegseth said before going to Yemen. And we're going to be different from what the Biden administration was. And they have been defeated by Yemenis and they left the region. And right now, it's the same argument with Russia. The new sanctions, we're going to be tougher than... Do you get why are they pushing so much for ceasefire? What is that? I assume that is not the United States strategy. It's the Great Britain, it's the United Kingdom strategy.
Yes, I entirely agree with you, Nima. I think that Trump shouldn't care, and I think he doesn't. Well, you've noticed that Western media is no longer providing updates on the war in Ukraine. Because there's no longer any way that they could present it as a stalemate. The Ukrainians are getting crushed. Their military is disintegrating. There's increasing reports of mutinies and turnover in the command of the military forces. So they don't want this. They don't want the Western public to know. They're even trying to publish news that, oh, Russians are beginning to lose the war now, which is completely ridiculous. Anyway, the Ukrainians are losing them. They're losing very badly. So a 30-day unconditional ceasefire is what they desperately want in order to stop the progress of the Russians, in order to stop the implosion of the armed forces of Ukraine, and to be able to have 30 days to regroup and rearm and prepare to renew the fight on a more advantageous basis. This is, you know, this is the priority of the Europeans and of the British. But the Europeans and the British have powerful allies in the United States. You know, there's a lot of banks and corporations in the United States that have, you know, bought into the Project Ukraine and that are heavily invested. Citigroup, BlackRock, to name just two. But, you know, there's also, Monsanto or, you know, one of these big ag companies or more of them. And so they want Ukraine to be defended at all costs because this is where their, you know, this is where their investment is. This is where they see future profits coming from. And so I think that Trump probably doesn't want to make an enemy out of all these people. You know, BlackRock could be a powerful enemy. So could be all of these big banks that are invested in the Project Ukraine. And so I think that a way to deal with that is to manage the thing incompetently or at least come across as incompetent. You know, if you don't want to do a job, but refusing to do a job could be dangerous or risky for you, well, then you can do a lousy job instead, you know. Same effect without maybe suffering the same consequences and punishments. So maybe this is Trump's and his administration's. So they get, you know, they do the talk again for public consumptions. They talk about being tough and sanctions and this and that. I'm not sure that they mean it. You know, I'm not sure that they mean it. I think that one thing that is that has been quite consistent in Trump's first term and the second term is that it seems to me that he wants to unroll U.S. role as the defender of the Western Empire, to come back home, you know, to focus on industrialization of the United States, reviving the American economy, and trading with the rest of the world. You know, after all, he's, you know, he made his fortune on investments and trade. And I think that that makes, well, that makes better sense for everybody, unless you're invested with the rules-based global empire.
Europe and the situation of Europe continues to be a very important concern on the part of Russians. You talk about BlackRock, and you look at Germany today, and we know that the Chancellor of Germany, Merz, was in the leadership of BlackRock. And the situation for Russia, when Russia looks at Europe, it's not just continuing the same, it's getting worse. And do you think that the United States has some sort of understanding on the way that Russia thinks about Europe? Because after all, whatever happens in Ukraine, the security architecture between Europe and Russia would be the most crucial outcome of any Ukrainian settlement.
Yes, I agree. And I think that the Russians will probably have to continue their fight against the West. And by the West, I don't mean, you know, the people of the West, you know, the Polish people, the German people, the British people, none of that. But the governing structures that have created the incentives that keep pushing Western powers to wage war almost on a constant basis against Russia and against other nations. They keep colonizing other nations and plundering their resource wealth. And I think that this will never stop. This will never stop unless those structures of power are completely dismantled and unless we have a reform in the monetary system. Okay, because it's in the monetary system where the incentives for conquest and colonization of other nations originates from. And I think that the Russians couldn't possibly succeed in this without the cooperation of the United States. Because even if Vladimir Putin throws out the bankers from his country, Vladimir Putin will die one day. And, you know, for the past 5 or 6 centuries, these bankers have proven themselves extremely capable of burrowing their way in back into the structures of power and co-opting them and infiltrating them and turning nations into either colonies and vassals or into their hosts. You know, so, you know, I think that the epicenter of all this is the city of London, but very powerful satellites are Wall Street and Paris and Frankfurt and Tokyo and Stockholm and so forth. And so they would, without a doubt, they would be able at some point in the future to burrow their way back into Russia. To completely uproot them, I think that it would be necessary for Russia and the United States and China to cooperate on that. It will take a long time. The struggle will probably continue in diplomatic ways, but also in legal ways. Russia would have to pressure Western jurisdictions to overturn the Magnitsky Act, which has been enacted in some 30 Western jurisdictions, starting with the United States in 2012. And basically these Magnitsky legislation laws, they erect a barrier between these Western jurisdictions and Russia or other nations that might want to pursue legal cases against bankers in the West. Trump, I don't know whether Trump is on board of this, but we know that Trump wants to reform the financial system as well, that he wants to introduce a new monetary system. And I suspect that this is part of what Trump and, you know, Trump administration is already discussing with the Russians and with the Chinese. And I think that this uprooting these parasites, uprooting this, you know, the globalist imperial cabal and dismantling their system of governance and their monetary system is probably the most important thing that these powers like Russia, China, Iran, United States could possibly do. But it will take a very, very long time. And it really requires the cooperation of the United States, because if they, you know, if you can limit them to the city of London and Paris, then you can exert pressure on France and on Britain to cooperate. And how could they cooperate? They could cooperate by overturning the Magnitsky legislation and by opening their legal systems to lawsuits and investigations from other nations like India, like China, like Russia, like Iran, all of the nations that have been plundered and pillaged during the colonial period. And then to be enable them to trace the plundered wealth to the ultimate beneficial owners, which are going to be, you know, the banking families in the West, like the Rothschilds and the Barclays and the, you know, I don't know who else, but they're people, they have names, and they need to be disenfranchised, because they are the ultimate instigators of everything bad that we have seen for the last 500-600 years in the Western world, well, in the world in general.
Alex, when it comes to Donald Trump and his information about what's going on in Ukraine, and in the terms of what are the capabilities of Iran to fight him back, here is what he said about the Iranian drones.
I asked one of the companies, I said, I want a lot of drones. And, you know, in the case of Iran, they make a good drone. And they make them for $35,000-$40,000. So I said to this company, I want to see it. They came in 2 weeks later with a drone that cost $41 million. I said, that's not what I'm talking about, $41 million. I'm talking about something for $35,000-$40,000. We send thousands of them up. And that's a great way. And they're very good, too, and fast and deadly. Horrible, actually. When you look at what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, the drone is killing tremendous numbers of people. You hide behind a tree and the drone comes down and it circles you with fire. You don't have a chance. The tree comes down also.
Yeah, the good thing about Donald Trump, the way that he's reporting on the information that he has, he's so honest the way that he's expressing himself. Alex, Iran has signed a military agreement with Belarus after the strategic agreement with Russia right now with Belarus. Armenia is preparing to buy air defense systems from Iran. I don't know, just today they have announced that. China and Russia are getting closer. And do you think that this sort of things that are happening, these sort of changes that are happening, would somehow facilitate the peace in a long term, or we're going to see some sort of clash, some sort of devastating conflict between the two parties that are shaping up right now, the East and the West?
Well, I think that these changes are absolutely facilitating peace. Because, you know, the way the British Empire and then, you know, the American Empire have been able to keep the world at war has been by having a monopoly on financial credit, on advanced technologies, and on advanced weaponry. And this has been extremely important to them because, you know, like if you have those three monopolies, then it makes perfect sense for you to keep everybody at war and to keep the world in chaos, because, you know, to wage war one against the other, you know, Azerbaijan against Armenia and Turks against the Kurds and Iran against Iraq and Iran against Saudi Arabia and, you know, everybody against everybody. To be able to prevail in war, they have to come to you for the weaponry and for the technology. And they have to come to you for credit. And so you lend money to the one side, you lend money to the other side, you sell weapons to the one side, you sell weapons to the other side. And then when they can't pay you back, then you say like, well, okay, you have some oil underground there. So, you know, why don't you open your oil resources to our corporations and our banks are going to finance that. And so all your wealth is going to be flowing towards our financial centers. And so this has been the recipe for the for centuries now. So now, if the Western monopoly on all those three elements of power are being eroded, I think this is making it possible for the world to transcend these centuries of total and nonstop warfare. You know, we didn't have nonstop warfare in Europe and the United States, but the global South has been constantly and deliberately mired in warfare because the Western colonial powers had the interest in keeping them insecure, at war, poor, and dependent on them. And so, you know, they never built infrastructure for them. They never built educational institutions for them, ports, any of this. And so now we see that I have to make it clear, this has a very, very important cultural dimension, because many people assume that in the very same ways in which the Westerners have been rapacious and rotten towards the global South, that of course the Russians are going to be the same and the Chinese are going to be the same, and, you know, but this is not true. This is not correct. You know, there's a cultural dimension to this, and the culture that has become prevalent among Western powers is not the same as the culture that you find in Russia and in China. Russians have never enslaved other people. The Chinese haven't either. They never colonized other nations. They have a different approach. They want others to be prosperous so that they can trade with them and sell them their wares. I mean, that makes perfect sense. It's not even complicated. But I think that we in the West have been so completely entrenched in our own philosophies and our own ideologies that, you know, they trace back to John Locke and all of these, you know, Joseph Malthus, and it's a very twisted, dark view upon humanity that only sees the world as a place to exploit and control and plunder and pillage, which is not necessary. It's not the only way forward. And so I think that an important way that you have to transcend that is to make it possible for nations who would otherwise be target of colonization for Western powers, to make them able to defend themselves without resorting to the Western powers for weaponry, because obviously they're not going to give you the weapons with which you can defend yourself against them. They will only give you the weapons with which you can wage war against your neighbors. So, you know, important advances in modern weaponry in China, in Iran, in Russia, are now making it possible for these weaker nations to build up their defenses, like Burkina Faso, for example, as we've seen. And Vladimir Putin has actually been explicit in that the weaponry that they're developing today will make it possible for the nations of the global South to defend themselves against predatory West. So I think that is definitely moving us into a new era, which will hopefully be an era of peace and prosperity for everybody involved.
Alex, Professor Jeffrey Sachs recently had a talk in which he mentioned the role of the British Empire in what's going on in Gaza. He mentioned that the region was, they sold that region to Arabs, then to the French, and then to Israelis. Three times they sold the region to three different groups. And the case of, we, in the last 10 days, we didn't talk to each other. And it was a conflict between India and Pakistan. And this is the outcome of the British Empire and the way that their policies. You see everything that we're dealing with right now, it seems this is somehow coming from the British Empire and their policies. How long can we have this sort of policies pursuing us, because right now, if we cannot get along with each other and just being trapped in those policies by an empire that has collapsed, there is no British Empire anymore. Why are they, why the problem are still there? We're not capable of resolving that.
It's the, you know, the problem is not Britain per se. You know, even if you limited Britain to the British Isles and you imposed an embargo on them so that they remain locked there and they cannot contaminate anywhere else in the world with their system, you would still not fix the problem, because the same patterns of behavior and the same system of governance has emerged from the Dutch Empire and, you know, the Spanish in the New World and Portuguese and any colonizing nation has conducted themselves in a very similar way. The British have maybe been marginally more violent and marginally more devious in the way they have conducted their imperial policy, which is what made them more successful than other empires and made them bigger and wealthier than other empires. But essentially, it's not in the people, it's not in the geography, it's in the system of governance. And I think that system of governance ultimately traces its root to the monetary system and to the banking families that control it. And, you know, over centuries they've funded educational institutions, they have infiltrated institutions of religion to kind of, you know, the Vatican has always been on the side of the bankers for many centuries. I think that they have infiltrated and contaminated the Judaism as well as Islam to suit their purposes. And so even if Britain wasn't on the map, even if it didn't exist, so long as you don't transcend this system, you're going to have the same exact problem. And so I think that what is necessary to do, as we just discussed a few moments ago, is you need to reform the monetary system. And I think that beyond reforming the monetary system, there has to be a spiritual and religious revival to take conscience in the way certain practices like usury can really spill poison into societies at large and create these disparities of power and wealth, where wealth polarizes, one strata of society becomes predatory against the lower strata. They exploit them, then they, you know, you have repression, then you have incentives to go and wage war abroad, and then, you know, we come back to the same point where we started. We really need a new system. And I think that as far as I've paid attention and researched this, the Russians and the Chinese are very earnestly and seriously exploring new systems, which would then, let's say, they would bypass these incentives that then drive pathogenic behaviors, colonization, conquest, warfare, and repression at home. And so this needs to happen. I think that we all probably need to put our heads together to understand that we have the opportunity to transcend this period of history. And I think it's extremely important that the United States is on board with that transition. I think that at the moment we're in a good shape, but it's going to be a long road ahead for sure.
I think that would help the United States in a long run, because if we just remove the power of putting sanctions on other countries from the United States, that would be so much helpful for the United States.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, the American people would become prosperous once again, and you wouldn't see so many homeless people on the streets and drug addicts everywhere, and the infrastructure falling apart, and their cities looking like third world dumps. You know, all of this would, well, you know, we've seen very recently in our lifetimes an example, a case of this happening exactly, because 25 years ago, Russia was exactly in that position. In 1999, Russia was an absolute basket case. It was run by an oligarchy of seven bankers. It was called Sembankirshchina, you know, exactly the oligarchy of seven bankers who at their will nominated or sacked government ministers, depending on whether they were, you know, serving them well or not. And then came Vladimir Putin, and he changed the game completely. And he lined up the oligarchs and he told them, okay, these are the rules from today on. You stay out of politics. And from that point on, Russia went into a renaissance, into a revival. And today, Russia, if you compare Russia of today to Russia 25 years ago, is day and night. Today, Russia is an advanced, technologically advanced, prosperous, and powerful nation. Whereas 25 years ago, it was almost like Ukraine today. I think that the average salary was something like $85 a month. The infrastructure was in disrepair. The military force was disintegrating. The country was on the verge of disintegrating. And it was because it was ruled by a handful of oligarchs. And the West today is ruled by a handful of oligarchs. And what gives them power is their control of the money flows and of the monetary system and of the banking infrastructure. And so, you know, the whole West should do what Vladimir Putin has done. Meaning, you know, put the oligarchs in their box, and you say, you know, run your businesses, enjoy your profits and your wealth, but stay out of politics. You don't determine how this country is going to be governed.
That would hugely need the reform in the process of the policymakers and the situation of the internal situation of the United States. That I don't know if that would be possible. We still don't have, they're talking about democracy, we still don't have a third party in the United States to be able to be elected. what type of democracy is that?
Yeah, it's pretty much a fake democracy. And I think that's even an empirical fact. You know, Princeton and another few American universities researchers, they've conducted extensive research to see whether, you know, policies as they're being formulated and implemented, whether they reflect the will of the people, meaning the ordinary people, or whether they reflect the will of the oligarch class. And they came to the conclusion that it's very obviously the policies are being formulated around the priorities of the oligarch class. So that's the fact, you know, the facade, the sham, the fake democracy that we have is basically to string people along. You know, now you vote Democrats and then they screw you over, and then you vote Republicans and then they screw you over, and then you vote for Democrats. And so you're always waiting for the next 4-year term to, you know, sack one side and elect the other. But they're all, you know, they're all puppets of the same ultimate interest in society, and they're all implementing their policies. And you know, all the people get is basically this runaround of the ritual of voting for these people and those people, and ultimately coming to the conclusion that it's futile, that it doesn't serve any purpose. But, you know, to the credit of the American people, by electing Trump, I think they've really set a new course. And I think that to the extent that Trump survives and is managed to push forward, even if we move millimeter by millimeter from the way things were before, it's an improvement. And I think that, like most, like many other people, I find myself very disappointed sometimes over Trump's policies and disillusioned and but we have to also remember what the alternative was, and the alternative was Kamala Harris. Yeah. And I believe that if Kamala Harris was in the White House today, that the United States would resemble Keir Starmer's Britain much more than what we have today. So we have to take into account that the vote in November 2024 did make a huge difference. And then that should be an encouragement for the people to continue pushing and demanding change and supporting Trump in implementing this change, and then pressuring them from deviating under pressure from other interest groups.
Thank you so much, Alex, for being
my pleasure, Nima. Always good to join you. Warm greetings from Monaco to everybody watching.
See you soon, Alex.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.